All right, guys, we got a ton of news to get to coming out of week 11. And we've also got a great guest who was on the ground for one of those big news-making stories to break everything down for us. Plus, as always, we're going to wrap things up today with all of your questions in the mailbag. Let's go. All right, welcome in. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. Week 11 is in the books, and God, did we have a lot of news across the NFL and across the football landscape in general. Tons of stuff even before we got to what happened in Sunday's games. We will cover that. We will cover all the rest of the news. And we got a great guest coming for you that's going to help us address one of these news topics. So look forward to that. But first, my five takeaways from week 11. And the first one did not happen on NFL Sunday. It did not happen on NFL Thursday. It did not happen on NFL Monday. It's the dislocated hip injury to Alabama quarterback Tua Tagovailoa. Obviously, you feel horrible for the kid. And this complicates a lot of things. The first of which is going to be his decision on whether or not to come back for his senior year at the University of Alabama. He has 1 year of eligibility left. There was no question among NFL people that he was planning to come out. I know that some agents had recruited him. So there was absolutely no question that he was coming out before this. I think he probably still comes out. Just because he has prior injury history, and I don't know that for him it's worth risking it again. You get hurt again in 2020 as an Alabama senior, you know, now you're dead. Now your stock is really destroyed, and it is hurt at this point. I don't think there's any question about it. We're going to get more into this with our guests, but here's a point I want to make, and I think it's an important one to keep in mind. And I don't think it's crass to say that being injury prone hurts a draft prospect's stock. And I also don't think it's crass to say that NFL teams are right to look at it this way. Drafting a quarterback in the first round is about as big a player acquisition as a team can make. You are hitching your wagon to the guy. You are tying the job security of the head coach or the general manager to the guy. And so everything matters when it comes to evaluating those guys. Tua Tagovailoa, before he even had the dislocated hip, had two ankle surgeries, one last year in December and one this year. I believe it was in late October ahead of the LSU game. So this guy's got extensive injury history. And if you look at the history of quarterbacks over the course of the last decade that have gone in the first round that came into the NFL with injury history, with significant injury concern, you know what you find? That it's valid that teams are worried about it. And there are five guys I came up with that had significant injury history coming into the pros over the last 10 draft cycles that went in the first round as quarterbacks. Sam Bradford, Robert Griffin III, Marcus Mariota, Carson Wentz, Deshaun Watson. Those five guys all suffered major injuries in college. Those five guys have all suffered significant injuries in the pros. In the case of Sam Bradford and RG3, you could say that the injuries were a major part of, played a major part in short-circuiting their careers. Marcus Mariota, we're getting to the point where you can say that. Carson Wentz, it was absolutely positively affected his career. And Deshaun Watson missed significant time with a torn ACL. Can't say that it's affected his long-term viability, but he already has suffered a serious injury. And so, A, teams are going to be concerned about this. B, teams should be concerned about this with Tua Tagovailoa, a guy who's not overly big to begin with, who plays an aggressive style. So what happens with him? I think he falls. I think he's facing an uphill climb to go in front of Oregon's Justin Herbert or LSU's Joe Burrow in April. I also think he probably should come out because suffering another significant injury as a senior would take him out of the first round conversation based, you know, depending on how everything goes at the medicals from here and how the team's medicals come back in February and March. I would not say he's out of the first round conversation, but like I said, we're going to get into that more with our guest. Number two, my second takeaway, whatever you thought about Colin Kaepernick a week ago, today, on Tuesday, before the announcement came out on Tuesday night, last Tuesday night, that the NFL was setting up this workout for him, is probably what you think now. If you thought he could play, there's enough there that tells you he can play. I talked to a handful of teams that were there, that assessed the tape, that saw him live. They say he's still got a very good arm, very strong arm, still athletic, still can move. He's in shape. Part of those workouts, of course, is seeing the endurance. Does a guy fade late in the workout? He didn't do that. So he's got all of that. His accuracy is scattershot. His touch is here and there. So the good and the bad of Colin Kaepernick athletically is there. You don't know how he's going to be in a football situation until you see it, but athletically everything that you needed to see is there. So that piece of it's there. On the flip side, if you thought he was going to potentially bring distraction to your building if you signed him, he did nothing to dispel that. If you thought that he was going to have trouble blending in as a backup, which I've said this a million times now, NFL teams want their backups to blend in with the furniture, you still have that concern coming out of this. And so I don't know that the ball really moved in one direction or the other after last week. If the goal was to get on an NFL roster, I don't think that I don't think he helped himself. I don't know that the NFL helped him all that much either. I think the NFL's goal here was to manufacture a put-up-or-shut-up moment to shift the narrative. Thought that was the whole idea here. And I think Kaepernick's goal was, quite honestly, going into Saturday, probably to make the league look bad. So you had two sides trying to make each other look bad going into Sunday. It wasn't about football. And I don't know that what we saw and what we've seen over the course of the last week changes anything. Number three, and this one's fresh. Phillip Rivers, 28 for 52 for 353 yards. Sounds okay, right? On Monday night against the Chiefs. One touchdown pass, four interceptions, a 49.6 quarterback rating. So I've been asked this question a bunch this morning. Can Phillip Rivers still play? I think Phillip Rivers can still play under the right circumstances, and the Chargers are going to have a decision to make. His contract is up after this year. They don't have a viable answer behind him right now. So the question becomes, what does Phillip Rivers have left if you're going to bring him back? I think Phillip Rivers right now is at the what I would call the John Elway with Mike Shanahan stage of his career. Okay? John Elway, when I was a kid, when I was a really young kid, when I was in elementary school, John Elway was capable of carrying a team. He got teams in 86 and 87 and 89 that probably weren't Super Bowl caliber teams to the Super Bowl. He carried them. By the time he got to the late 90s, he wasn't capable of doing that anymore. But the Broncos created a situation around him where he didn't need to do that. And so they had the running game with Terrell Davis. They had a great offensive line. They had Rod Smith, Ed McCaffrey, Shannon Sharp. They had a top five defense. He could throw for 150 yards and win the game. So can Phillip Rivers still play in that context? I think he can. Can Phillip Rivers still kind of fix everything, plug every hole when he's got Trey Pipkins and Trent Scott as his tackles? Probably not. And so I think too often we just look for a guy to fall off a cliff. I think that's where Phillip Rivers is right now. You just have to be really good around him. If you're really good around him, you can win with him. The extreme example of this, of course, was Peyton Manning in Denver in 2015. I don't think he's there yet, where it's just the whole thing's coming undone. But I do think he's lost a little, and I do think that you have to be really, really good around him to win with him. And so the fact that Russell Okung got hurt, the fact that they've had Hunter Henry in and out of the lineup, the fact that they've had Melvin Gordon in and out of the lineup, the fact that the defense is really good but not as dominant as they had expected when Derwin James has been healthy, all that plays into it. Number four. So every week at the MMQB, we do power rankings, and I got to put them together on Wednesday morning, and I think this morning or Tuesday morning, and this morning we had a tie. I can't remember the last time that happened. Tie at the top, the Ravens and the Patriots. I personally had the Ravens one, and I had the Patriots two. And here's why. I had the Ravens number one because I believe their big deficiency has been, for the most part, managed. Okay? The deficiency early in the year, after losing Eric Weddle and Terrell Suggs and CJ Mosley on defense was on that side of the ball. And losing that amount of infrastructure hurt them early on, but they kept working the roster. They signed Josh Bynes. A lot of people didn't pay attention to this. Beginning of October, it stabilized their front seven. They cut Timmy Williams. That sent a message to the rest of the roster about how they wanted to be tougher. And then they traded for Marcus Peters, which when they got Jimmy Smith back and they have Marlon Humphrey, who's now one of the best corners in the league, became a legitimate strength. That might be one of the strongest position groups in the league right now, the Ravens corners. And so I have the Ravens number one because they had a issue on their roster that they've now shown they can manage. The Patriots, whose defense is still awesome, and who still have a quarterback who I think, you know, there's a little bit of that like Elway with Shanahan thing going on with Brady too, but they still have the quarterback they can win with, and they're good enough at the skill positions, has its issue on the offensive line. And so the same way the Ravens manage their defensive issue, the Patriots have to manage their offensive line issue. They'll get Isaiah Wynn back. Can he stay healthy? They're relying a lot on a guy who's played 82 career snaps. Good player, relying a lot on a guy who's played 82 career snaps. The right side of the line hasn't been as good. I'm talking about Shaq Mason and Marcus Cannon. So can the Patriots manage their offensive line issue the way that the Ravens were able to manage their defensive issue? It'll be interesting to watch. And I got to mention the game Lamar played. Again, efficient, 17 to 24, 222 yards, four touchdowns, no picks. Spectacular on that run as part of a 86-yard effort on the ground. I mean, what's amazing to me about Lamar is you can look at his numbers, and if you look at the total yardage, in a lot of cases it's sort of good, not great, but the impact he has on every play is unbelievable, which makes him so much fun to watch. So Ravens are my number one, Patriots are my number two. Finally, number five, Myles Garrett. He'll have his appeal hearing on Wednesday. My understanding, the way this is going to go, his appeals hearing is going to happen in New York. He's doing it in person. That's his choice. Larry Ogunjobi had his over the phone on Monday. Marquise Pouncey has his over the phone at 4 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday. Myles Garrett will be going to New York to sit down with the league on Wednesday. Myles Garrett's argument, I'm told, is going to center on the union trying to tell the league that they need to put a number on it. There can't be an indefinite suspension for something like this, because that is basically the equivalent of banishment. And so they're going to bring up the case of Vontaze Burfict, who had a ton of priors. Myles Garrett doesn't have the priors, who got 12 games. They put a number on that. They're going to bring up the case of, and a lot of people don't remember this, Antonio Smith swinging a helmet at Richie Incognito. He got two preseason games and a regular season game. And so they're going to make the argument that there needs to be an actual number on this. It can't be indefinite. And that going into next season would be excessive. And the one last thing I would say on that whole mess at Cleveland from last Thursday, I would just say this to you guys. I think the biggest problem I have with the whole thing was, look, Garrett's suspension, I think, was automatic. We can all agree on that. Pouncey, I love what he did defending his quarterback, but you can't kick and punch on the field. So like the suspension in that case is automatic too. I thought what Ogunjobi did and what Mason Rudolph did, I thought neither of those offenses were suspendable. But to me, it was like, okay, well, based on the circumstances, I can understand where you'd suspend a guy just because of all the noise around it and everything that happened there. You're sort of contributing to a larger problem. I can understand it. But I thought that the thing you needed to do there was you either suspend both of them, so that both were like borderline suspendable, or you suspend neither of them. And both of them played a part in inciting everything. Both of them took cheap shots. Again, I think if those things happen in a vacuum, they aren't suspendable offenses. I can understand where you would suspend them based on the circumstances surrounding their actions, but either suspend both of them or suspend neither of them. So I think Ogunjobi should win his case on appeal based on Mason Rudolph not being suspended. And now we'll get you guys to our special guest right after this. All right, now we're going to bring in our guest for this week, a buddy of mine. one of the best draft guys in the business and somebody who covers college football too, who should be able to give us a lot of insight on Tua Tagovailoa's situation. ESPN's Todd McShay, welcome in.
How you doing, Albert?
I'm good. All right, so I want to start here, and I know you've been around Tua a bunch. You did three of his games so far this year. What was your first reaction when you saw the news and you saw how serious the injury was? As somebody who's paid to grade these guys, to assess these guys, and who, you know, in a lot of cases, and this one included, knows these guys, what was the first thing that popped into your head?
Well, I mean, first of all, I was standing 5 yards away from him as they're cleaning up his bloody nose, and I had no idea at the time what happened. You know, because he was on his knees, and all of the medical attention was going to his face. You know, they were putting gloves on. It's just standard procedure because there was so much blood coming out, and they were trying to get the blood to stop coming out. And then all of a sudden, once that process was done and they kind of lifted him up, then you knew something was wrong because he wasn't putting any pressure on his right leg. And then, you know, fast forward through the whole process of trying to figure out what was going on and talking to the doctor and Molly McGrath getting reports yep. as well from their group, you could just sense something serious was happening. And it was, you know, it's just brutal. And then when I got to the airport, and we knew it was a hip injury at that point, but got to the airport getting ready to fly out of Golden Triangle Regional Airport, and then heard about him getting airlifted and the hip and all of that. So it was, first of all, just knowing Tua, having sat with him, having spent hours of time either with him, with people who, you know, are close to him, and then also just kind of digging on into who he is as a person with people he spent a lot of time with, you know, all the people around him. So it was really, it's just sad to hear the news, and it's the last thing that you want, and especially the circumstances too, where he didn't have to be in that game, and that's not really, you know, what we're here to talk about, but knowing that was a moment that he didn't have to be on the field, and just watching it as it was happening just was kind of gut-wrenching. So I felt for him as a person, and I still, you know, still feel for him, and my thoughts and prayers are out there for his family and him, and I know what he's facing. The good news is he's had surgery, and by all reports, it went extremely well, and now it's just a recovery process. He's supposed to be able to make a full recovery, and if that's the case, then when it's all said and done, hopefully there won't be much lost here. But what you have to do as an evaluator, first of all, you have to make your evaluation of him. And mm-hmm. I thought he was the best quarterback in the class. I see the lack of size. You know, I see the weaknesses. We can get into him as a player. But the first thing as an evaluator you have to do is decide, where would you take him if he was 100% today? And then you have to get with the medical staff, and they've got to kind of walk you through. And each team that has any interest is going to spend a lot of time medically trying to figure out what they think the recovery is going to be. Is it truly going to be full recovery? Is there any potential for long-term, you know, degeneration, or is he more likely to get this injury again? And then when do we actually get him, I think, is the least important of the three medical questions, but it is a question because you might be looking at redshirting him as a rookie. So those are kind of all the factors that go into it. And you say, okay, well, maybe he's not the first overall pick. Maybe he's the 15th. And so that's not that big a deal. He's still a first-round pick, and I agree. And it's all about getting the second contract, but you've got to look at it face value. That first pick in terms of guaranteed money is north of $30 million, somewhere in the $30 to $33 million range. When you get down to 15, you're looking at about half that money. So there could be a net loss here in terms of just guaranteed money of around $15 or so million because of that injury that he suffered.
Did you guys think he was playing going in?
No. We talked to Nick the night before, talked to Coach Saban the night before, and he was honest with us. And And it turned, you know, sometimes coaches will say things and they're not 100% sure. They just really, especially in the case of starting quarterback, they don't want the information to get out too early. But generally speaking, in those production meetings,
there's trust there, right?
If they have any trust in you, they'll give you information. And he said exactly what happened. He said, listen, I don't know for sure. Tua's going to come out. He's going to warm up with the medical staff. They're going to let me know if he's able to go. Then I'm going to talk to Tua, and if he's able to go, you know, see if he how good he feels physically. And if it's a go there and the movement skills are good and he's confident in how he feels, he's going to play. And so I saw him warming up. He usually comes out in full uniform and does his whole routine. Or not full, but like, you know, the leg pads and all of that, and comes out and throws the ball and looks like everyone else on the field. He came out and he was in just the jumpsuit, the warm-up, you know, and was going through different drills than he normally does working out. I've seen him probably 7 or 8 times live on the field, so I kind of know his routine at this point. And it was a different routine. So then he came, he was the last player out of the Alabama locker room, but he was in pads when they came out for that full workout about an hour, you know, 45 minutes, 50 minutes before kick. And he started off with the backup center and was just, it wasn't the same routine. So even 45 minutes before the game, it was our thought, and from talking to some assistants, we knew he could play. We knew he wanted to play. It just was a matter of whether he was going to start or not. And my guess based off the conversation and what I saw on the field was that he would be the backup and Mac Jones would start. And if things went wrong, they could smash the glass, pull in case of emergency, you know, mm-hmm. and bring him in. But it was the other way around. They went with him, and it sounds like it was going to be the end of the day for him, but he wanted to get back in the game and play. And Nick saw an opportunity to give him a couple more minutes on the field, and it went as close to as bad as it possibly could have gone, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's like I've always kind of felt like in the first half, I don't know, it's like hard to criticize a coach if a guy's playing, right? Like where
totally, I get it.
Yeah, I mean, like it's just it feels like you have to get the, like at some point they only get, I mean, 12 regular season games plus whatever postseason.
He's been injured. And he felt great.
Yeah.
They were protecting him. I understand it. I said before it happened, I thought I was surprised that he was on the field still. Brian Griese said it. A lot of people said it. It doesn't matter. Nick Saban has won more championships than any of us will ever win, and he's run his program the way he's run it, and he's been ultra successful, and part of that is because there's consistency with the message and there's constant competition. And by consistency with the message, I mean, you know, if you're capable of playing, you're going to play, and you're going to play as long as this thing is competitive. And 28 points is still a competitive game. I understand, but you know, it doesn't matter at this point. What matters is that Tua had successful surgery. He's a great player. He's an even better individual. I mean, you can't be around a better young man than Tua Tagovailoa. And so you wish the best for him. And now for evaluators, the process is going to be intense for these teams, you know, at the top, like at Cincinnati, Miami, some of these other teams that need a quarterback. They've got some really difficult decisions to make. And the frustrating part is you can't make it today. It's going to be a process. And every day that goes by, you're trying to kind of monitor his progression and where you think he's going to be medically moving forward.
If he came to you today and said, should I declare, what would you say to him?
I would say yes.
And why?
Because he doesn't have the biggest of bodies. He's proven what he can do. I don't need any more tape to evaluate him physically. I understand that he's going to, you know, let's say it is 8 months and it goes into July. And let's say you do have to redshirt him for a year. That's not the worst thing in the world. You know, there are a lot of Hall of Fame quarterbacks that were able to sit a year and watch. You know, it doesn't mean you have to. But there's a lot of examples of guys that have benefited from a year of watching and learning before being thrust into the starting job. And so I just, going back a year kind of prolongs it. He's had a great career at Alabama. He had the magical moment in the national championship game. I mean, what more do you need to prove at Alabama? And I hate to say it, and I usually don't, I'm not pushing either way. I'm just saying, if he came to me and asked the advice, it would be, you've taken enough hits on that body. Let's get 1 year closer to your second contract, and let's get you in the league and start, more importantly, developing so that you're ready to play. And you can spend every minute of every day preparing and getting ready and rehabbing, kind of like Nick Bosa did a year ago.
Right.
You know, he benefited greatly from having that time of rehabbing, preparing, and kind of getting into a pro mindset even before he was drafted this past April.
Right. And I actually think of like Lamar, you know, and like how falling in the draft may have like been a blessing in disguise for him, because he went to such a good situation. You know what
no
I mean?
Question.
Like, and if he'd gone in the top 10, he's not going to a place like Baltimore, you know? And like, so he gets into a situation where the team is ready to win when he's on the field, and he's got coaches who are, you know, sold out to make it work for him. And I just sort of thought about that like over the last couple of days, like, what if he falls into New England's lap? What if he fall? What, like, what if, you know, he gets into a position where maybe Pittsburgh trades up for him in the bottom of the first round? Whatever it is,
right? Yeah,
you know,
Pittsburgh,
like,
or the Chargers, or you know, one of those organizations where, Chargers is a better situation than going to Cincinnati or Miami.
Right.
Just be blunt, you know.
Right, right. So how do you how does this affect the way that you evaluate him then? Like, when you're looking at him and you're, okay, like, where do I put him? Because I assume that's, like, pretty complicated now, right? Like, where do I put him versus Joe Burrow? Where do I put him versus Justin Herbert? Where do I put him potentially against Jacob Eason? Like, I would think that this sort of complicates that,
it
right?
It absolutely complicates it. And it's I don't want to say the worst case, but it's frustrating because you want to evaluate the player on who he is. And I had him at one. Now, Burrow has been ascending since the minute this season started. And Joe Burrow from LSU to me is the guy that probably stands to benefit the most, if you will. And he does because, unfortunately, because of Tua's injury, but also because he's played his ass off this year. I mean, Burrow, he's been darn near flawless. I know he had a couple picks this past week, but you look at what he's done in big games, big moments throughout the year, and how quickly he's processing information, how comfortable he is in the pocket. You look at all the great quarterbacks, whether it's Breeze, Brady, Aaron Rodgers, all of them in different ways. I know they have different mobility and different skill sets, but all of them excel inside the pocket in terms of feeling it, knowing when to slide away from inside pressure, knowing when to climb the pocket when there's outside pressure, but they all trust the pocket. They don't have to look around to figure out where the pressure's coming from because they feel it, and they know exactly when to get the ball out at a very high percentage. And that's what Joe Burrow has shown this year. He's going to hang in that pocket. He feels it. He's more mobile than Brady, obviously. I mean, he's mobile.
He's
can
an
pick
athlete,
up and run.
But
his pocket presence, and then the ability to kind of adjust his arm angle and get the ball out right before taking a hit, and then the toughness that this dude's shown. I mean, he gets hit. It's like hit after hit after hit. And not only does he peel him, it's not like he's peeling himself off the floor. He's popping right up like nothing ever happened. I've just been so impressed with this guy this year. And I think he could very easily wind up being the first quarterback taken. Then you get into Justin Herbert, who's got the big arm. Very different cat in terms of his personality, more of an introvert, and he's basically open about it, but has come a long way in terms of leadership. I think people get the wrong idea with Herbert because he's this big presence. He's got great mobility and he's got this big arm. And then you hear like, well, he's just a different individual. People think he's a bad guy or there's some negativity there. There's not. It's just that you're not getting your classic in-your-face, you know, vocal leader type of guy. But you're getting a player that if you really study the sidelines and study the how they are on the field, his teammates absolutely love him and would run through a wall for him. And he's so competitive, too. He really is. He's just kind of a quiet guy in the room. He's going to sit in the corner of the room, and he's not going to command a lot of attention. But, you know, you could say the same for several successful quarterbacks in the league as well. So his inconsistency with his accuracy, I think, is going to be the big issue. But he's improved in that area as well. So you've got Burrow, you've got Herbert, and then you've got Tagovailoa. And I think depending on what the medical is between now and then, it could differ. And obviously teams are going to have different opinions. But I thought Tua was just slightly ahead of Joe, but Joe was tracking. I would go right now Joe Burrow, Justin Herbert, then Tua Tagovailoa is my top three. And then you've kind of got that second tier of Jake Fromm, Jacob Eason, and probably and Jordan Love,
who hasn't had a great year, right?
What's that?
Who had like Jordan Love, like who hasn't had like a great year, right? Like he's just been like,
right.
A little
he struggled, but he does have physical tools. I think he's more of a second round pick, but you never know when it comes to quarterbacks.
Okay, let me ask you this then. I actually did some research on this, and I looked it up, and I was just like, I was trying to like rack my brain for like, all right, like who were there medical concerns with as first round quarterbacks over the last 10 years? I came up with five. Sam Bradford's
one, right?
Robert Griffin III. Yep. Marcus Mariota, Carson Wentz, yep. Deshaun Watson. All five of those guys had serious injuries in college. With Watson, I think it was a little bit more of a freak thing, but
and it was the year before, right?
Right, right.
Wentz was that year. We came back at the end.
Yeah, Mariota had like a high ankle sprain that I think kept him out for a little bit at Oregon, and he kind of fought through it. Todd, all five of those guys got hurt again in the pros. You know what I mean? Like, I wonder if like seeing like that, like, I know we all kind of want to minimize it because I think everybody wants what's best for the kids, right? So we all want to sort of minimize it and say, well, you know, it's bad luck and everything else. But there is an element here where, like, guy gets hurt in college and guy gets hurt in the pros, right? Like, and Tua does have the two ankle surgeries on top of this. So I would think for, especially at a position where availability is so important, where your team kind of like ebbs and flows based on the quarterback, I would think it has to be a factor with Tua, like, right up to the very end.
I absolutely agree. Now, again, you have to weigh the situation, and you have to trust your medical staff and what they come back with. But you'd be ignorant if you didn't factor it into the evaluation. Let's say on the field you have the same exact grade between, let's say, Burrow and Tua.
Okay.
Right? Same exact grade, but now you're looking for, you know, a difference maker, a tiebreaker, if you will. Even if your medical staff comes back and says, you know what, he's going to be completely fine in June, and it's going to be a full recovery, and we don't think this is going to be anything that affects him or leads to future problems with his hip down the road. Even if that's said, because of the history, because of the position, and because one's got a frame that is a little smaller, than Joe Burrow, and certainly smaller than Justin Herbert, you have to go with Burrow over Tua in that case, if you have the same grade. So I think that's where it becomes a situation. And I also think you got to understand that if you're losing this guy for 3-4 games a year, which seems it's becoming the trend with Tua, it's just that he's not holding up physically, even though it's not – nothing was significant. It was just the ankles before this, but physically his body clearly is struggling to hold up, and he's going to take more hits, bigger hits from bigger dudes that are coming faster in the NFL. I think it definitely has to factor into the evaluation.
Okay. Last thing for me then, because, you know, the college kids are sheltered to a certain degree, and you guys get them in the production meeting, so you have like that insight to them. Can you think of anything that you've, like, any encounter, any interaction you've had with Tua over the last couple of years that kind of like sticks out? You said you think he's a great kid. Anything that sort of sticks out that you can tell people, like, this is sort of who I think Tua is as a player coming into the NFL?
Well, as an individual, he's highly competitive. Just in talking to him, he's really smart. Like, his football, I don't know what kind of student he is or anything else, but his football intelligence is really high. he's adjusted as they've adjusted over the years. And then just talking to him, he's got this really confident way about him, but he's, I don't want to say mild mannered, but reserved, you know, it just everything, nothing's a big deal to him. He's got it, you know, and everyone kind of picks up on that confidence around him. You know, it's Alabama. The circus is all around him. He's got all this stuff. He handles it well. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't like going out. He hangs out with his brother every night, he says. There's no kind of risk for anything character-wise. And when you're done meeting with him and talking to him, something's wrong with you if you don't just really like the guy. You know, there's always drama around him, and I've done three of the four times he's been injured, I've been at the games, and it seems like it's always like situation and scene, and he's the Alabama quarterback, and there's 50 people, members of security and the support staff and all that, but he can't control that.
Right.
You know, he's just trying to play and compete, and he did. He could have easily been like, Coach, I'm not, you know, it doesn't feel that good. Now I get 14 more days before the Iron Bowl and playing Auburn. And instead, he's out there, and based off of what Molly said, what Brian and Steve Levy saw on the game, and what Nick Saban then said when he went to the podium after his interview with Molly McGrath, it was really Tua that was trying to get back in that game. And I think Nick appreciated that competitiveness and let him go back in, even though Mac Jones was warming up and Mac Jones thought he was going in. So that kind of tells you who he is. This is, what was it, 35-7 at the time?
Yeah, 30. I got it up here, 35-7.
There's no reason for him to go back.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, it's interesting because, like, when you were sort of explaining him there and how level he is, right? Like, and how it's not too big for him. Well, that's what allows a kid to go into the national championship game at halftime, you know, and like turn that game around.
Like it was a 7-on-7 drill.
Yeah, like he's 18 years old and he can step into that environment and bring them back from, what was it, 20 down, whatever it was, and then throw the game-winning touchdown.
And make that throw.
Yeah, the throw in overtime.
Yeah.
Yeah, no question. Okay, you can check him out. What game you got this week?
This week we've got USC-UCLA.
Okay, so you can
not
check.
Not the greatest slate, but
USC-UCLA
nonetheless.
Well, I wouldn't turn down a trip to L.A. You can check him out on USC-UCLA this weekend. And, of course, all of his draft coverage is coming over the next 6 months. Todd, always appreciate it.
All right, Bert. Take care, man. Appreciate it.
All right, and thanks as always to Todd. He's a great dude and does a great job on the draft coverage. You guys can always check out his work on ESPN, on their website. His draft stuff is there year-round. And now we're going to jump into our mailbag for the week. You guys know how this works. Every week, I put the call out for questions. There are two ways that you guys can get to us now, the way we're doing it, the way we've done it during the 2019 season. You can email me. Email our account at breermailbag@gmail.com. That's B-R-E-E-R, my last name, mailbag@gmail.com. Or you can call us and leave a voicemail, 201-596-4346. That's 201-596-4346. We'd love to hear your voice here on the podcast. That's how you can get your voice on the podcast, to call that voicemail number. Shelby, question number one for week 11.
From Paul. Obviously, there are only 32 head coaching jobs in the NFL, but Zach Taylor had to know the Bengals are mismanaged by Mike Brown and that the coach there would have no chance. Now Taylor is 0-9 and on the way to 0-16. Are most of these candidates so desperate that they're willing to go to franchises where they won't have a prayer of winning?
No, I think Zach Taylor genuinely wanted that job. He coached at the University of Cincinnati. He was the offensive coordinator there. In 2016, I think it was. So he and his family had been there. He liked the area. His wife liked the area. He, I think, looked at it as a chance to grow with an organization that was going to be patient with him. And that was the big thing. I mean, look, Marvin Lewis made the playoffs there 5 years in a row, from 2011 to 2015. There are circumstances there that are unique. The scouting staff is very small. The coaching staff has a hand in scouting. But you're going to have control over the roster. You're going to have a good amount of say-so in the way the roster is built. You're going to have a chance to shape things in your image. and you've got an ownership group that has typically been patient with its coaches. And so there are positives there. Now, I think what Zach Taylor and his staff found in Cincinnati was a little bit more broken than they expected it to be. The quarterback, obviously, that situation is what it is now. Andy Dalton, I think, can still play. Can he carry a team? No. But outside of that, as far as guys who can be building blocks going forward, Tyler Boyd, A.J. Green, Geno Atkins, William Jackson, there aren't a lot of guys beyond that. And Joe Mixon would be another. There aren't a lot of players beyond that aren't rookies right now. And I do think that they feel like that there are some guys in that class who are going to contribute going forward, like Jonah Williams, who's been hurt, obviously, and Drew Sample. But there's a building process that needs to go on there. And I think part of Zach Taylor wanting that job was, A, he liked the area, but B, he was going to be given time to build. And as he and his staff have figured out, that time is going to be necessary based on where the roster is. Shelby, question number two.
This is from Sean. Hey, Albert, I was wondering what your thoughts are on the situation in Detroit. Bob Quinn has been there for a while, and they don't seem to have any real hope or direction. I was wondering if you think there's a chance they can make some change and real overhaul.
I don't think that it's impossible that there is change there. I just don't think we know what the owner is going to do, because Martha Ford, she has not been – she doesn't have a huge amount of track record. The team was run by her husband for all of those years. He had traditionally been very, very patient with his coaches. He had traditionally been very, very patient with his general managers. Jim Schwartz lasted there for a long time. I think did a decent job rebuilding the franchise, but lasted there a long time. Matt Millen lasted there a long time without much success at all. So the history there is that they've been patient. I do think that there are some good things going on there. And I do think that they've got a base of players, guys like Kenny Golladay and Taylor Decker and Frank Ragnow. Matt Stafford, obviously, when he's healthy, I still think is one of the better quarterbacks in the league. Jared Davis on defense, Devon Kennard, Trey Flowers. Like, there's a good base, I think, there. And they've done a nice job of sort of giving Matt Patricia players that are his types of players. But it's year four for Bob Quinn. We've got 2 years of evidence on Matt Patricia now. So, certainly I think that this is going to come down to an owner, an owner that doesn't have a huge track record on whether or not she's patient or not. So I think that a change could be in play. It was rumored before the year that something could happen. I do think there's been some positive this year. If I were them, I would stick with it another year. We'll see what Martha Ford does. Shelby, question number three.
From Brandon, can you explain what is different from a typical NFL waiver form to what Kaepernick received on Saturday? Do typical waiver forms include the clause about employment?
I, to be honest with you, I'm going to plead ignorance on this. I heard it was pretty similar. Most of the waiver was pretty similar to what you would see a player sign before the combine, a player sign before a pro day, a player sign, well, not pro day is a little different, but a player sign before the combine or a player sign before a workout, a veteran free agent workout. The employment clause was interesting. I think the fact that this thing wasn't taken care of right away on Wednesday when the waiver went to him sort of it just opens up a lot of different questions. And were these two sides ever really willing to work together? Were they ever willing to find middle ground? And we've seen where the league has sort of thrown little things in the past that have been deal breakers. Was the league willing to work around what Kaepernick's lawyer said? In the end, they weren't. But Kaepernick's side dragged it out into Saturday. It's just the whole thing was mismanaged from the start. And mismanaged by two sides that, quite honestly, haven't done a great job of working with one another over the last 3 years. Shelby, question number would be four?
Yeah.
Question four.
From Mark, if you consider the 49ers and the Patriots being the best teams in their respective conferences, both teams aren't really playing great football at the moment. I know their records would suggest otherwise, but the Patriots' offense looks pedestrian, and Jimmy Garoppolo still seems to be tentative, and I'm not sure if he can deliver in a big moment. What are your thoughts on these teams making their conference title games?
I think what's fascinating about those two teams, the number one and number two defenses in the league, and it's not really that close. Now, can you win that way in today's NFL? Last year, I think a lot of people would have said no. I think this year, what we've seen across the NFL, which has sort of been an under, let's say underreported story, is defenses punching back. And if you look at the top defenses in the NFL, most of them are, it reads, and I'm going to pull it up now, it reads pretty close to what the top of the standings would be too. I gave you New England. I gave you San Francisco. Both those teams have just one loss. Buffalo, they're number three. What are they? Three losses? 7-3, I think. 7-3 Buffalo. Denver's the outlier. The Chargers are number five. But after that, you got the Saints, the Cowboys. Most of the teams that are playing good defense are close to the top of the league. And I just think that this is part of maybe a league-wide trend where we saw last year wasn't really a revolution. It was an evolution. And now we're seeing how all of this stuff is cyclical. So I think New England and San Francisco certainly have things to take care of on offense. Jimmy's got to play better. The Patriots need to fix their offensive line. But those defenses have been steady over the course of the year. And I think they give both those teams a chance to compete into January. And if they stay on the pace that they're on right now, it's only going to take each of those teams one win to get to their conference championship game because both those teams would have byes as it stands right now. Shelby, question number five.
Have a voicemail.
Hello, I'm with Chiefs Focus, and I'm just wondering what the Chiefs should do with their running back situation. You know, Damian Williams is dealing with a rib injury. McCoy, he's pretty good, but he's in evaluation for concussion protocol. And Darrell Williams is pretty good, but he's our third string as of right now, and Darwin Thompson is a rookie, so not sure what the Chiefs should do. Who should be our running back number one? And, yeah, just let me know.
Well, thanks for the question. I always appreciate the voicemails coming in. Certainly what we saw last night was running back by committee, and I think that's the way it's going to continue to be. Darrell Williams with 11 carries, Shady McCoy with 7 carries, Damian Williams with 4 carries, Darwin Thompson, if they're going to use him, I think it's going to be more in sort of the Darren Sproles type of role. And so I think this is the way it's going to be. We've seen in the past where Andy Reid's been able to manage these sorts of situations. I don't have any problem with them doing it the way that they've done it. I think it'll continue to go that way for them. And really, to me, the more important thing is going to be the health of Tyreek Hill offensively, and then all the issues they have on defense. So I understand where you got some concern over it coming out of week 11. I also think that this is probably way down the list of the Chiefs' concerns, again, behind Hill's health, behind some of the injury issues they've had on the offensive line, and behind what's going on in defense. Shelby, question number six.
I have another voicemail here.
Hey, Albert, this is Brad. Love the podcast. Love all your work. Wondering if you can talk about the Buffalo Bills' success this season and how you view their outlook, not only for the rest of the season, but the next few years under McDermott. Thanks. Keep up the good work.
Well, thanks for the question, Brad. I appreciate it. I love the plan that they've put in place there. I love how they did it a little differently. And some of this may have been almost by mistake because Brandon Bean, the general manager, didn't get there until after Sean McDermott's first draft. But the way this whole thing's set up, where they held on to some of the older players that had been there in year one, competed, established a program, set a foundation, made the playoffs, then ripped the Band-Aid off, fixed the cap issue, and built from the ground up in year two, has worked out great. Because what you did was you established what you wanted to establish from a cultural standpoint, you established a level of expectation, and you gave the players results. And that's so important that the players were able to see that you gave them some results. And so now you build from the ground up, and they've got some fantastic, fantastic young pieces, particularly on defense, with Tre'Davious White, with Tremaine Edmonds, with Matt Milano, with Ed Oliver, defensive tackle. I love where the Bills are going. A lot of this is going to boil down, again, to where they are at the quarterback position and how Josh Allen plays. But as far as how they built the rest of the roster through those draft picks with kind of mid-level free agent signings, guys like Mitch Morris and Cole Beasley and John Brown, I think that they've continued to build on that foundation that was laid back in 2017, and I think that their record right now is probably more a result of their schedule. Their schedule hasn't been great this year, But I certainly think that there is a foundation there. I think they're probably a year away from being where they want to be. Shelby, question number 7.
From Mike, with the success of the Raiders and the downturn of the Bears this season, what's your take on the Mac trade a year plus removed?
And that's why I think we always have to wait. You know, like the Minkah Fitzpatrick trade looks great for the Steelers. Let's see what the Dolphins do with that first-round pick. The Amari Cooper trade looked great for the Raiders at the time, but you know, Amari Cooper wound up playing really well for the Cowboys. And so, you know, I think that like the initial analysis is always a little bit of an issue. It's always a little hard. I think now the Raiders have a chance to come out of this fantastic. Because really, if we're boiling it down, and I know there were some pick swapping later on and everything else, but really, if we're boiling this down, it's about the two first-round picks, right? It's about the 2019 first-round pick, and it's about the 2020 first-round pick that the Raiders walked away with. So one of those picks is Josh Jacobs, who's the Offensive Rookie of the Year leader right now, and I'd say a runaway leader for Offensive Rookie of the Year, who's become the focal point of your offense in year one, and you have him on a rookie contract, which isn't insignificant because you were going to pay Khalil Mack over $20 million a year. So you've got him under contract for the next 3 years. He's the Offensive Rookie of the Year, and now you've got a Bears pick that looks like it's going to be in the top 15 or so. So the Raiders have done great. This is about hitting on your draft picks. The Raiders have hit on their draft picks. A lot of people have killed Mike Mayock, or killed the hire of Mike Mayock. A lot of people poke fun at what the Raiders did over the course of the last year or so. You know what? They've got a rookie class to build on. They've got a coach who's clearly still got it. They've got a quarterback who has really taken to the coaching. There's a lot of good going on as they head into Las Vegas in 2020. They got a shot to make the playoffs this year. I think they're going to be even better next year. And if they can hit on that Bears pick, now you're talking about having two guys in Josh Jacobs and whoever that pick is at under $10 million a year, right, for Khalil Mack, who's making over $20 million a year. So not only are you going to have the two players that you got for him, you're also going to have eight figures of flexibility financially in free agency. So I think it's, again, the Raiders are going to look really good right now. They've got a chance to look even better. But that's about being able to hit on your draft picks. And, man, Mike Mayock has done it. Appreciate you guys coming out. As always, we want your feedback here. We want to make this your podcast. We want to make this a destination for you every Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday morning if that's when you choose to listen on your commute. Always appreciate the feedback you guys give us. So that's what I'm looking for. You can get me on my Facebook at Albert R. Breer. You can get me on my Twitter at Albert Breer. You can get me on my Instagram at Albert_Breer. And you can get all of our podcasts in one place right now. You guys know that, right? It's all on the MMQB NFL podcast feed. My podcast, which pops here on Tuesday afternoons. Jenny and Connor's podcast, which pops on Wednesday mornings. We've got the Monday morning podcast. We've got the Deep Dive podcast. We've got the Gambling podcast. All that stuff is on one feed. And on a separate feed, you can get the MMQB News podcast, which I'm also a part of. If you need your news during the week, every afternoon that goes up. It's about a 5-minute bite-sized podcast. If you want to catch up on what's happening in the NFL, it's a good way to do it on your ride home from work. You can get both podcasts, again, in separate feeds on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Same time next week. I'll see you guys then.